Hey, I'm Renee April and you're listening to Tea and Tales. On today's episode, I sit down with best-selling author Peter V. Brett to talk about his series, publishing, and life in general. Enjoy!
Thank you for having me. No worries at all. There we go. I've already messed up a music transition, so we're right on schedule this morning, but it's not like yesterday, which was a bit of a didn't go so well.
Yeah, thanks to time zones are tricky.
Yeah, thanks to ISPs, that was a good time and a half. So I'm just getting some audio levels right. There we go. OBS decided to just to completely mess with us this morning, so I had about 30 seconds to fix everything today. So it's just the smoothest of smooth starts. Everyone is saying welcome on in. Yes, Axagoras, you absolutely have to be on your best behavior, please. Please, best behaviors. And you're here on your bread behavior? Yes, there we go. So let's have a quick chat. Would you like to introduce yourself a little bit? Tell us about your work, your career so far.
I'm Peter V. Brett. I'm the author of the Demon Cycle series from Delray Books in the United States and Harper Voyager in the UK and Australia. The Demon Cycle is 5 novels and 4 optional novellas. It's a completed series as of 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm also launching a new series starting with The Desert Prince this August, which is related to the Demon Cycle series, but you don't need to have read one to enjoy the other.
That's brilliant. So we are continuing on in the same world as the Demon Cycle series?
Yes. The new series will take place 15 years after the previous series ends with a whole new cast.
Oh,
so new readers can pick it up without having to have read the older books, but people who have read the series already will see some familiar faces.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
What was it like getting back into the world of Demon Cycle? What, returning to this landscape, a very familiar place for you, I dare say. Was it a little bit of nostalgia?
There was. It was harder than I expected. I kind of, for the length of the first series, I felt very confident about what I was doing and where I was in the world and what I wanted to accomplish. And then I ended the last series with quite a bit of finality, intentionally so that could stand on its own as a completed series that people can binge and stop there and feel comfortable. So when I restarted things, like I moved forward quite a bit in time and had to extrapolate where the world had gone in that period of time and introduce a whole new cast and see how they fit into the world. So it ended up being a lot more challenging than I thought. I also switched in this new series from third person to first person, which is a much more intimate form of storytelling.
Yeah.
And there was quite a learning curve for me in making that switch.
Yeah, absolutely. A perspective shift is a big change. What was it like? Yeah. Do we have multiple point of view characters, or do we just have single point of view first person?
We have 2 point of view characters.
Okay.
And so in third person, you're expected to show, don't tell. You sort of describe the action and let the reader fill in the emotional content. And in first person, you put the emotional content right there. Like, that's what guides the perspective. So that was a big shift for me. And like, certainly between the first draft and the second draft, there was a lot of changes as a result of that.
Yeah.
But I think it allows for a much closer and more intimate style. And so I may introduce some other POV characters as the series goes on, but I wanted to keep it very simple for this first book. So we've got 2 main characters that we really get in close with.
Oh, that is fantastic. And we're looking at August for The Desert Prince?
First week in August. I think Australia actually gets it first.
That's a surprise.
Because your books come out. Don't your or so it's which day of the week do new books come out in Australia?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I just know that we usually get everything last.
In the US, it's on Tuesdays. Okay. And then the UK and Australia is like Wednesday and Thursday, but I forget which one it is. So they're all coming out the first week of August, but different day depending on which continent you're on.
Yeah, okay. I did not know that there was a specific day for new books to come out. I'm going to have to look that up, and that's the days that I'm going to head to Dimmicks, I reckon. There was something I was going to ask. So with the perspective shift, do you feel like we get a different view at the world? So we did, 5 books in third person and a couple of novellas, looking at this world in a third person perspective, and now we go in to first person, which, as you said, is a lot closer. That's going to really shift the perspective of the kind of the world. I'm trying to figure out what I'm trying to say here, but it's a different viewpoint, obviously. I think it's just going to be, that's going to be really interesting. I didn't actually know that you'd switch into first person. That's really curious. I like that a lot.
Well, you get, in first person, you get the commentary of the POV character, like along with the information about what's happening in the story. Mm. Whereas when you have a more objective narrator, you don't get that sort of bias in the text.
Yeah.
And that is really fun to play with and really like gives you room to do things that you couldn't do in third person. Definitely. But also limits you in other yes. ways.
Absolutely. Yes. I went from first person to third with the books that I'm working on at the moment, and it's just going to third person, there's so much freedom. There's just so many things you can write about.
It's true.
It's great. We've got a couple of questions popping up in chat. I just wanted to welcome on everyone in. How are you guys doing? Liz is asking, what are you reading at the moment? What is your current read?
I just finished The Burning God by Rebecca Kwong. Mm-hmm. It's the third of the Poppy War series. And it was amazing and sort of emotionally devastating. And so
I understand, yes.
I have the book hangover right now, so I haven't really decided what my next big read is going to be. So if people have recommendations, you're welcome to throw them out at me. I'm mostly doing audiobooks these days.
Yeah.
You know, it's a pandemic and I have children at home, and sitting and reading is just not as easy as it when I didn't have a 4-year-old running around the house.
Oh yeah,
and
so I can imagine.
I'm mostly going out for walks and listening to audiobooks. So I just finished the Burning God audiobook.
Oh, that is
looking for something a little lighter.
Oh yeah, definitely not Robin Hobb. That has been my most recent read, and she's just
she'll cut you deep. Oh, Robin cuts deep.
She's yeah. I was like, oh, no, this seems like a really fun fantasy series. I'll give it a read, and then I got to the third book in the all the names have fallen out of my head. In the Fitz trilogy, and my brain was just like, I can't, not anymore, no more, please. I'm going to go and read something happy, I think.
Well, no, she is literally the nicest human.
Is she really? Have you met her before?
Yes, I've met her. Like, we cross paths quite often at conventions, like, all over the world, and she's the nicest human.
Oh, that's so cool. You're living the life. That is brilliant. Oh,
back in the day when we used to go places.
Oh, right, you're telling me. We've not been allowed out for a year now. Our borders have been closed, so we are rattling at the bars of Australia again. Haddis is asking, do you have your own Infinity project, a story that's been an idea or attempted many times throughout the years but will probably never get made? Which I understand is probably a bit of a tricky one.
I mean, I had a series prior to the Demon Cycle that I wrote that I put a lot of heart and soul into, but it was mostly while I was learning how to write and going back and fixing it with what I know now would probably be more work than just writing something new.
Yeah.
And so those books, like, are just going to be forever in the trunk. And like, even though there are some bits of them that are beautiful and I love, as a whole, they're just not of the level of quality that I would want to share with anyone.
Absolutely, I understand that.
But Demon Cycle, this world has been my playground for 12 years now, and I've still got, you know, a few more years in it, and I don't feel like I'm ever going to run out of stories. It's a big enough world that, like, I can tell any kind of story just by going to a different place in the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Character.
How do you keep all your world building straight? Like, because this is a large world that we're talking about. What kind of notes organization? Because we've got a lot of world builders in chat right now, and we mess around with World Anvil, just keeping notepad documents. But what would you recommend for keeping facts straight?
I mean, everyone has their own way of doing it, and so I can tell you how I do it. But every writer I know has their own method, and they all work. I have a massive MS Word document. I've created a table of contents that's hyperlinked.
Oh my.
So when I open it up, I can jump to, like, I call it Demon Cycle Appendices, and it's hundreds of pages long, and it's every person, place, or thing I've ever made up. You know, what's the distance from this place to this place? Like, you know, who was alive after this book, this book's climactic battle?
Yeah.
You know, like, so the names of all of the characters, like every, like, and a lot of information that has never really been in the books and doesn't need to be in the books, like the currency systems of various different, like, countries and cities in the world. And, like, yeah, occasionally, like, somebody will buy something and I'll say what the coin is called. And there's, like, a ton of information behind, like, that.
The clats? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, the clats. Where, like, I know way more about clats than you would ever be interested in knowing.
Oh, you underestimate how much I love this series.
And so, like, and, like, there's a whole currency system in, like, every city. And you don't really use that much.
Yeah.
But the writer needs to know how it works in order to make it sound like commerce makes sense there or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I am very diligent about maintaining that file. I update it all the time. Any working file that I'm using has, like, a mini glossary of, like, stuff I made up while I was writing it. And then every once in a while I paste those into the main file. Mm-hmm. So that's always accessible if I forget something.
Yes. How often do you backup that document?
I have backups of my backups of my backups.
Okay.
No chance of me ever losing work.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness. Love is the Only Cure is very excited for the next book, which is just always nice to see some enthusiasm in chat. And Walter would like to ask, regarding character development, are your characters pre-realized or do they grow as your story unfolds?
Yes. I think that every character, you start with an idea of who you want them to be, but then as the story goes on, they have to make choices that you didn't expect. And when you decide what those choices are going to be, they grow. And over the course of time, your characters can then end up in a very different place than you first envisioned them.
Yeah.
I went into this new book with a pretty clear idea of who I wanted the characters to be, but by the end of the book, they were very different from that.
Yes.
And that's just part of the creative process.
Absolutely. Would you say that there is almost a, not a danger, sorry, my brain is working on about 4 hours of sleep. If someone goes in with a set idea of what their character is going to be and they're not going to deviate from that and this is just how the character is, would you say that that does a disservice to the book and the writing overall or the potential of the character development?
I mean, it would depend on the circumstances. I think that if you are so... I plan a lot of things in advance. I write out, like, a whole skeleton of every book before I start writing the prose. I know, you know, 200 pages of what's going to happen before I start working on the flavor of the writing. And so I am a big believer in planning things out in advance. But if along the process you have a better idea, even if that means you have to pull a bunch of threads and fix a bunch of things, you always have to go with a better idea. You can't be so wedded to your outline that you give up a chance to make it better. You can always improve.
Thank you. I have a writer's group every Saturday morning and you've just saved me a lot of time having to explain something very important to them. Because that is exactly how I feel as well. Starford wants to know, what would you say if someone approached you about turning your books into a game? Have you ever thought of a game medium adaption?
Yes, I have thought of it. And we've been approached in the past. We came very close to having a video game made and it fell through for reasons I can't discuss right now, although it's still a possibility, which would have been amazing.
That would be incredible.
Could still happen one day. We are in the process of making a card game right now. Whether or not that ever turns into something that's available, we'll have to see, but I am working with a games publisher right now to try and work out a system for that, and I'm pretty excited about that prospect too, but again, you know, you start these projects and like until they really feel right and you're like, this is something that I'm so excited about that I want people to be part of.
Yeah.
You just have to sort of tinker on them in the background.
Absolutely. I've kind of in this industry learned that until it's on the table in front of me or you've put pen to paper on something, it's kind of all speculation. And like we can speculate for days, but until there's a physical object with us, it's like, okay, now we can actually put this a bit out there and spend a bit more time on it than you would just with a lot of stuff coming across your desk and a lot of proposals and ideas and projects and stuff like that. Yeah.
And I'm fortunate enough to be content in my career enough that I'm not going to put out something unless I'm really proud of it and I feel like it's worth it. I don't want to, you know, do something that's not my best work just because I'm excited to have a different kind of project out. Like I want to really feel like, okay, I had to do this because it was awesome.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You absolutely need that for sure. Books Are My Crack says, like Uno, pick up +3 callings. And I love the name, Books. Welcome on into the chat. How you doing? Walrus is
Yeah, I mean, the ward system really sort of lends itself. The ward system really lends itself to like a card game. So
yeah, it does. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the wards, actually, because they are absolutely stunning. Mm-hmm. There's definitely one of my community members who bought me the Clat. He has a ward tattoo like this. And they are just, they're so pretty. Do we want to talk through the design process of the wards a little bit?
Sure. I had a real vision for the magic system of these books. I want it to be very different from the magic systems of other fantasy books that I'd read, and even other fantasy books that I'd written. I wanted magic to be something that anybody could learn with hard work and practice. Mm-hmm. But I wanted it to be complicated and a lot of work and difficult. And I wanted the reader to understand what magic could and couldn't do.
So a hard magic system.
So that no time during the books do you feel like, okay, magic just swooped in and, you know, and now everything's okay.
Yeah.
Which happens a frustrating amount sometimes. And so I wanted the first book to start out very low magic and have it be a very human struggle of story where, like, you know, physical escapes and chases and things like that, and then have it develop from there into something more complicated, so that by book five, when people are flying and throwing lightning bolts at each other and whatever, it makes sense because you got there through like a sort of slow escalation, mm-hmm. and not because you opened up book one and people were flying and throwing lightning bolts around.
Yes, exactly.
So the symbol magic I thought was a really good way to do that. Almost every culture has some form of, like, you know, draw this and ward off the evil eye or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I built off of that to create this magic system. And when I planned out the wards, I had sort of a rough idea of what I wanted them to be like. And I tried to draw them myself and they looked like garbage. So I commissioned an artist, Lauren K. Cannon, to work with me to design the wards, with the understanding that, like, we'll make them together. She'll do the design, and then I would have the rights to them, and I could give them to whoever I wanted and do whatever I wanted with them. So we sort of built this partnership over the last now dozen years, where, like, every once in a while I call her up and be like, hey, here's the 6 new wards I need. And we discuss what they should look like, and we based it off of multiple kinds of character writing. To get these symbols that sort of look and feel like they really are a language.
Yep.
And create ways to design them together. But then I gave those to every publisher. I'm in 27 languages now, and I gave the designs to every publisher. And now in every language the books are translated, like, publishers love free art. So they use those same symbols, in China and in Russia and in Brazil. And so no matter what language you speak, if you go to my website and you see those symbols, you feel like, comfortable at the sight of them.
Oh, that's incredible. I love that so much. Oh, wow. That's really fantastic.
It was like the wisest thing I ever did.
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine. But how does it feel seeing something that you've pictured in your head? Like, yes, I have this ward system. And then to have someone come back to you and be like, here they are. Did you just see them? Like, yes, this is exactly what I was thinking.
She designed hundreds of them, you know, I think we have 36 like official wards, but that's out of hundreds of sketches. And so like there was a lot of back and forth to get to the point that we're at, but for a writer, like seeing your work come to life, is always just amazing. And I've been so incredibly blessed with amazing cover art. And like the ward symbols, and Lauren also does a lot of illustrations for my books. And she did a number of the character portraits that were on my website. And so working with artists to bring the characters and like world to life has been incredibly gratifying, but also gratifying has been like so many fans have put their own spin on things by doing fan art and tattoos and that sort of thing, and sort of saying like, this is how I saw it, and maybe it's not how you saw it, but like that also like is just so, it's incredible. And nothing makes me happier than to see a new piece of art.
Absolutely. Well, Love Is the Only Cure says that they have a light ward on their wrist, up a little bit now, but how many, you see a lot of tattoos coming through, because the wards kind of lean towards tattoo designs.
I never expected this to happen when I first started writing these books, but there are literally hundreds of people with ward tattoos. If you go on my Facebook page and click on the album, the picture album for tattoos, there's probably more than 100 pictures on there. And like, those are just the ones that I know about where somebody sent me a picture and told me it was okay to put it up. So there are also people that sent me pictures that didn't give me the permission to share it. And there are also people that I don't even know about. And so it makes me so happy. And it really is an honor when people do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever seen one in person? Like, has someone ever come up to you at a con and just been like, yeah, check out my
Yeah, lots
tattoo.
Of times.
Yeah?
I don't think that I've ever been to a convention where somebody didn't come up and do that. And it every time it's like my birthday.
That is amazing. Oh my gosh. That is, wow. That's next level, man. That's really exciting.
Yeah. We should start like a online community.
Oh, yeah. Don't know how to run one of those. Antheon wants to know, are you a coffee writer or a whiskey writer? What kind of beverage gets the writing juices going?
Coffee writer, definitely.
Coffee? Yeah.
I have never attempted to drink and write. I think that like that's, you know, there's like that mystique of the alcoholic writer, but drinking has never worked for me. All it ever does is sort of make me tired and give me a headache, or like make me want to go and do something, but it's never lent itself to writing for me. I'm much more of a coffee writer.
Absolutely. I'm a drinking editor when I have to be ruthless with the getting rid of stuff. I'll have a little bit of port and that loosens up the editing flow for me.
Yeah. Oh, look, I'll drink when I read my editorial letter. Like when the editor sends me their notes, I'll drink for that.
Before or after you just like get the notes, you're like, well, here we go. You just get some writer's tears whiskey in there. That's actually a bottle of whiskey one of my community members bought for me.
I'm more chocolate, sugar and coffee while I'm actually working.
Oh yeah, 100%, absolutely. Chat, we are working slowly through the questions. So thank you all for chucking them in. It's really, really fantastic. Demon and the Crows wants to know, what's the longest you've worked on a single scene? And do you live through the same day in a story over and over until you get it right or put pen to paper? So how long do you ruminate on a scene for?
It varies greatly. I mean, there are some scenes that are written as quickly as it takes to read them. And then there are other scenes where I will spend weeks like pacing back and forth and, you know, cursing the gods and like writing and rewriting the same scene over and over again. Usually anything that you read in one of my books has been rewritten at least twice.
Okay.
Oftentimes more, but at least twice. What I normally do is I'll do a day's writing, and then the next day when I start, I'll reread what I wrote the day before and usually rewrite most of it. And then move forward from there. So like there's an overlap every day of like revising what I did the day before after I've had a few hours to think about it, and then I keep moving forward.
Yep.
But there are certainly times when there's a feeling you want to evoke, or there's a piece of information that needs to come out, or there's a conflict between the characters that needs to be resolved in a way that gets them to do X, but that's believable and in character and convincing, that, like things like that. Sometimes it takes a while, and sometimes you have to, you know, go for a walk and try and piece it together. And like, it can be really frustrating, and it can mean that you lose a couple of days work because you're wrapped up in something. It's just part of the process.
Yes, unfortunately. Love wants to know, do you find it difficult to make intimate dialogue between characters? I've always had trouble making conversations flow smoothly. So dialogue.
Dialogue is actually one of the easier things for me. Dialogue and fight scenes, like if I could just make a book that's just dialogue and fight scenes, I would fly through it. I'm not one of those writers who never lets their main characters have the important conversation that if they just had, like everything would go easier.
Right.
I tend to have the characters constantly hash these things out in an ongoing fashion, which I think makes for a much better dynamic. And
yes.
Also really sharpens their voices.
Definitely. I remember being consistently surprised that that actually happened, because like you said, that is an overused mechanic where a simple conversation would resolve a lot of conflict, and it never happens. But there was one particular conversation between Leisha and Arlen I remember that them having, where they kind of just, I'm not going to put any spoilers in chat or anything like that, because there's a couple of people currently reading, but they talked openly about a topic that was very much between them, and I remember being really surprised that it was being addressed. I was kind of like, but where's all the miscommunication? So we keep getting this long rolled out drama for the next three books. It didn't happen. It was an adult conversation where they discussed their different viewpoints, their fundamental differences. And like you said, it really sharpens their voices. Absolutely. I completely agree with that.
And it made room for a whole bunch of new drama.
Yes,
that,
it did.
Like you didn't even know was coming.
It was
like,
so good.
I think that one of the things that I try really hard to do is not be predictable. I had a plan for Arlen and Leisha from the very beginning that I knew was going to diverge from what a lot of readers were expecting. And so I sort of got, you know, had the pleasure of holding that back and revealing it in the way that I wanted, but it also allowed me to have some of those hard conversations
yeah.
up front.
I'd say, yeah, those conversations that are also very reflective of real life relationships. Like in real life, there's not this happy ending, you know? You don't get together with someone, you don't meet someone, you fall in love, and then it's happy ever after. It's a constant flux of learning and communicating and rehashing conversations and where you stand and consistently learning about the other people. So it's been 3 years since I've first read the series, and I'm still heartbroken, but I understand. I understand, but my heart, when I think about it, I was like, oh, no, that's how it's got to be. But that's just how much I love the characters. So I'm trying really hard
not
to spoil.
Even when it's true love, it's still like a new battle every day of trying to understand each other, because people are complicated and understanding each other is not easy. And so you have to have room for your characters to be able to have a fight about something and sulk for a while and get over it and then still be together, or you know, come to a point where they find something like, okay, we can't get over this,
yeah.
and like we can be grown-ups about it, but that means that things aren't going to work out, and that's what life is about. And so I try to reflect that in my
exactly.
books.
Yeah, I found all the relationships throughout the book were very very well thought out and mature. There was not just a happy ending. There was drama everywhere, which was brilliant. But it suited the world. Like, this is a very tumultuous, dark, gritty world. One of the things, I started reading the book again the other night. One of the things that always catches me off guard, and Jov, I did see you in chat, by the way, and I do have your questions lined up, darling. One of the things that always catches me off guard about the beginning of The Painted Man is how brutal it is. Like that first demon attack at the house. I remember reading the books and I'd first started reading it, got a couple of pages into it, loved Arlen. So already I was like, I'm invested in this boy, and I adore him. And then this attack happened, which kind of, I felt, displayed how you were going to handle violence and the grim reality of this very, very real dark world. That's when I was truly hooked. It was kind of like a, oh my gosh, but I'm into it kind of way. So how did you go about finding the level of described violence? Because it's pretty up there.
It's pretty up there, but I think that it was necessary to... I think of the characters in the books as survivors. I think of the series as survivor stories.
Yeah.
Like, this was my life up until this happened, and then that changed everything, and now I have to figure out a way to go on. Mm. And so those moments, those pivotal moments, like the Arlen was pretty, he didn't know anything about the world outside of his hometown for most of his life. What was going to be the thing that was going to make him leave, and leave in a way that was so recklessly dangerous that he would be forced to like completely change himself in order to survive? And so it had to be something powerful and something extreme and really like a break from the life that he had known up to that point. And you'll see that throughout the series, all of the major characters go through a moment like that, where like, I thought my life was this, and then something happened, and now my life is that. And that's what drives who they are and helps them grow. And so it definitely, it's rough. That's a really hard scene, and it wasn't easy to write, but it was the defining moment of Arlen's life, and so it had to be something really powerful.
Absolutely, absolutely. And please correct me if I'm wrong, because I may be completely misremembering this. Also, T Wanderer, who's just arrived in chat, is the one who bought me the Clat. Big fan. Can confirm there.
Been looking out.
Yeah. One of the things I remember, and like I said, I may be completely misremembering this, so feel free to be like, you're crazy, it's 7 a.m, you haven't slept. But there was, I think you tweeted something about that scene where Arlen runs off into the forest and spends his first night out from behind the wards, and he's built himself a little ward circle, and there's a rock demon that is, and Arlen laughs at it, and it was your agent that was like, no, like, it's because it was a disproportionate reaction to a little boy out in the night for the first time. How did it feel to have to rework things?
I mean, I felt that the laughter was not real laughter. It was nervous laughter.
Yeah,
you know, it was kind of just like, I'm so scared that I've just reached that point where like, all right, if I die, I die. But like, you know, maybe I won't die. And like, so I think that like, I was trying to convey a mental state of just like, you know, I've given up and rolled the dice. But this is the thing, you have to be prepared to improve with feedback. And like, a lot of times your agent or your editor or your beta reader or whoever will say like, there's another way to say this. And sometimes, most of the time, the way they suggest is no better, but it forces you to say like, okay, well, let me see if I can find a better way to say this. And so, you know, the old adage that like, when your editor points out a problem, they're usually right. And when they tell you a solution, they're usually wrong, is something that I hold to.
That's very interesting.
Accept the problem, solve it yourself.
Okay. That's a really good way of looking at it. I really like that a lot, because I loved what that scene eventually turned out to be, but I completely understand like why that kid went through a lot very quickly. I can understand his mind just kind of being like, well, guess we're here. Guess we might die. So just...
Well, and at that point he was, you know, he was convinced he was going to die, and then like his idea sort of worked, and he was like, oh, maybe I'm not going to die. And that was what was supposed to drive that reaction, but it didn't sell. So I tweaked it a little bit until it did sell. And that's, you have to be humble enough to accept that your work can always get better.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I've worked with a lot of writers who do not have that mentality, and the only one it hurts is them.
I mean, a lot of times you need to have a whiskey and like think about it before you are able to be so gracious and admit that you could be better. But
it's the editor's note when you see it coming in. You're like, I know I need these, but I'm gonna live for another moment in a world where the book was perfect. Because when you start reading those notes, it's like, okay, yep, no, oh, all right, yes, I understand now. Oh.
I will start to write long arguments to my editor about why I was right. And then in the course of the argument, I'm just like, why am I even arguing this? I've already thought of a better way to do it.
Yes, that's the thing. It's like, it's momentarily being offended and then going, actually, you know what? That's a really good idea. And it's having the humility to understand those moments and embrace them and let the work be better for it, I think.
Never reply right away.
Never reply to feedback right away.
Always give it a couple of days.
Okay.
A couple of days to think about it and like separate yourself from your emotional reaction and get your logical reaction.
Good advice.
Nobody likes to be criticized, even when the criticism is right. Nobody likes it. So give yourself room to absorb it before you respond, so you don't snap at somebody who
is trying to help,
doing their job and is probably right.
Yes, exactly. That's some pretty solid advice. And I missed a bunch of questions further up here. Cut and Run wants to know, do you ever go into a book knowing you are planning something that could crush the readers? And I'm invested in this question.
Always.
Oh. Always.
That's like the one thing that I know going into the book is like, here's a list of things that'll crush the readers. Now I have to fill in the stuff in between.
I've never been so... I truly, even with Robin Hobb, I've never been so affected as I was with The Painted Man. I put the book down. You know the bit that I'm talking about. I put the book down and put it in my bedside table drawer and closed it for 3 days and didn't go back to it because I was just, it wasn't a criticism of the work. It wasn't me being like, oh, I can't believe you've done this. It was, I am sad and I'm heartbroken and I need to process this. And eventually I obviously went back and finished the book and worked my way through the series, but that is the most crushed. You absolutely have the title for the author that has crushed me in my reading life, which is a long time. It's a lot of books, but you hold the title. So well done, I guess.
I'm not even sorry. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry.
I wouldn't want you to be that. Actually, this evolves into Job's questions nicely, which is like we were talking about this yesterday. In a dressing gown when I got the time zones wrong. And this kind of like grimdark, gritty reality fantasy. Job is one of my streamers who was in chat before. He's come at me with a couple of questions. Talking about mixing post-apocalyptic fiction with fantasy and what inspired that, like any real life conflict that's kind of inspired the events or what was the inspiration behind the setting?
I mean, some of it was a careful construction of world building that I had been doing for many, many years, where I said, this is the kind of magic system I want to have. This is the kind of, this is how I want to build it so that it will escalate over time. This is like, I want the world to be these isolated places so that you can feel like it's a journey to go there and it's a big deal when you get there and everybody's different there. And so I created all these places that were very unique, but what really bound that all together and made it into a world that felt real was this pervasive sense of fear that ties everything together, particularly in the early books. And that I like, will say like very much came from being in New York City on September 11th. Like still, you know, it's been a long time now since that happened. But I remember that one day more than any other day in my life, everyone around me was terrified. All of us. Everyone in the city was terrified because we didn't know what was happening. And like we could see the fires from my office building. And like we didn't know if the country was under attack or if it was an isolated thing or what. And everyone reacted differently. Everybody was scared, but some people said, I've got to get home to my family, and they ran out. And other people said, I've got to get down there and see what's happening, or I've got to get down there and help. And people lined up to donate blood, and other people were sort of wandering the streets not knowing what to do, and some people were running around frantically. And like a couple of people in my office, myself included, were like, well, the subways are screwed and we're stuck here. Let's go downstairs and get a six pack of beer and wait this out and listen to the news. And so, because, you know, and it was that sort of variety of reaction to the same stimulus of fear that made me really think, like, okay, you're in a world where as soon as the sun goes down, demons come out and they try to kill you. Like, what does that do to people? How does that make people act? How does that make them treat each other? How does that affect the fabric of life that we would otherwise find familiar? And like, those are the questions that took like this sort of appendix of world building material and turned it into a world where like real things could happen and you could feel emotionally invested in it.
Yeah, definitely. I remember my friend came to me with The Painted Man and was like, you have to read these books. And as I'm sure you know, book recommendations just all the time. So it's kind of, for a book to get through that filter, that has to have something about it. And the something for me with your series was that at night it was basically people become prey. And that was fascinating to me, that freedoms were restricted in terms of, like, you have to get back to shelter before nightfall, that kind of thing. Like, that kind of mechanic has just always really interested me. So that was a really big draw to me picking up the series and starting it. And the talking about the fear and how fear shapes people and people's different reactions to fear, can absolutely see that throughout the series. Just how people's different responses to horrific events and trauma and fear beyond what the human mind can handle is definitely clear, definitely there, very well portrayed, and certainly just adds yet another layer to this is a world, it's real, it's brutal, it's dark, it's scary. If you're fearing for a character's life, it's probably because they're about to die horrifically, which is, you've got a little bit of the, I'm sure you probably get this comparison, I'm so incredibly sorry beforehand, you got a little bit of the George R. R. Martin kind of, yes, the character's in danger, so they're dead. That's how life works. That's how these mechanics work. How do you go about kind of facing the grim reality of, I've written this character into a tight spot. Guess it's time for them to die.
I mean, look, George kills a lot more people than I do.
That
so,
is very true.
I think that like, it hurts when I do it, but I don't do it nearly as often, One of the things, when I was still working on these books, I went to see George Martin speak once. And he said something that he's probably said at 1,000 events, where he's like, people are not superheroes. If somebody comes at your character with a knife, there's a good chance your character's gonna die.
Yeah.
And you need to feel like as the reader, another feel like there's a good chance that this person might die.
To the queen.
And if you lose that, then you've lost something like fundamental about like the emotional another content of the story. It's moved out of reality and into something else. And so I've tried to hold to that. And you know, when the characters are in danger, they're in real danger.
Yeah, exactly. And I really love that, because there's nothing more frustrating than just a book where everyone kind of, there's no danger, there's no stakes, there's no fear. And like you said, fear is a very core element, sorry, forgive the pun, of the series. And without that, I don't think it would have hit as hard. I don't think it would have had as many stakes as it did if there wasn't actual true danger and really horrific consequences sometimes.
I mean, look, there are no rules to writing. I mean, there are certainly stories where you have a cast of characters and in every book, like they get into trouble somehow and they have some hijinks and they solve a mystery. And at the end, they're all together and they have a laugh and everything's okay.
Yeah.
And like books like that are fine too. You know, stories like that are fine too. There's no wrong way to do it. But that wasn't the tone that I wanted in my books.
Yes.
So...
Absolutely, and I'm so sorry. Someone's just chucked a bunch of gift subs in there. That's what all the noises were. Rum, thank you for the 5 gifted subs. I appreciate that. It scared the crap out of me. I was not expecting that this morning, so thank you very much for that. And Fionn wants to know, is there something to Joseph Campbell's hero's journey idea? Because Arlen's journey follows it a little bit. The archetype?
I mean, I read... So it was the Hero of 1,000 Faces, or... I read that in college, like... I mean, I guess I might have been influenced by it somewhat, but I didn't you know, I wasn't like looking at that as a template for how to tell a story. Like, it was just one of many books on writing that I read over the years.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think it provides a template maybe for someone starting to get into writing and learning their writing skill? Is that like almost like a little process you'd give someone just to kind of get the kinks out of their voice?
Look, I think that there's a lot of books on writing that are really helpful. There are ones that have helped me, and there are ones that other people have read that I haven't read that have helped them. Like, you just need to approach it from a place of where you maintain your sense of self, where you can say, like, I'm going to look at how this person does it, or this person's advice on process, and I'm going to take the bits of that that are useful to me, and I'm going to leave the bits that are not useful to me, because everyone's brain works differently and everybody gets there a different way. There was a quote from Tom Cruise in Interview with a Vampire, when he's talking to Louis about turning into a vampire, and Louis says, like, it was like, why can you read minds and I can't? And he just says, the dark gift comes to us all differently, or something to that effect. And I feel like that's how it is with writing. Like, there are a lot of ways to get to the same place. And so you have to find the way that works best for you, and seeing how other people do it can help and can give you ideas. But in the end, you still have to be you when you're writing.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, different manuals are going to speak to different people in certain ways, because I've definitely got my hands on a couple of writing manuals and just been like, this does not mesh with me, does not vibe with me or my style. And Fionn wants to know if you could name two writing books potentially for keeping the dark gift of writing in mind, as Johnny's called it.
So the book that I would say was the most helpful to me was called Writing to Sell by Scott Meredith. Scott Meredith was a big time literary agent in the 50s. This book is out of print, but you can usually find it pretty cheaply on Amazon used, and it's worth reading. It was written in the 50s. It's very dated in some ways, but it basically is an agent saying, I've sold, you know, many, many bestsellers over the course of my long and storied career, and they all had these things in common.
Okay.
And so if you want to write a book that actually sells and that people are interested in reading, like, this is the way to build it. I didn't agree with everything in that book, but there were a lot of things that definitely felt like a light switched on in my head, and I was approaching writing in a very different way after that. I really like adore Terry Brooks's Sometimes the Magic Works. Terry was a hero of mine when I was a kid, and so that probably plays a part in that. Same thing for Stephen King's On Writing. That's also worth reading, and it's a nice little book. The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield is also a really good sort of pep talk, in addition to like some ideas about how to approach writing. So I think that's four books.
Yep, brilliant. I think Anfion's noting them all down for everyone in chat. Thank you, Anfion. That's very kind of you, darling. There was a question up here from Walrus, which is interesting. Walrus is one of my most interesting writers. He is a short story master, basically, and writes very, very curious tales about living fruit and dances that create magic and stuff like that. And he asks, have you ever wanted to write something completely different to your usual style, but set in your world to see if you could make it fit? Which is a very niche question, so feel free to take a break.
I think I do that by switching characters. So over the course of the Dune cycle, I've had 12 POV characters, and no two of them are alike at all, really. I think that they're all really unique, and they span like a pretty wide range of age, gender, station in life, and career choice. And so it really, like, each one is jumping into a whole new thing, like, where I have like, all right, I've already figured out how to write these characters, now I'm going to do somebody totally different and have to approach that. And I think that's what interests me most about writing, and what I like about this world is that I can tell all kinds of stories by jumping from person to person. I can tell this one and it's sort of like a Western, and this one's more like a traditional epic fantasy, and like here I'm gonna throw in a little romance. And so I try to do that. I also have another series that I'm starting to work on that I've been like tinkering at for a couple of years now that when this is done, I'll be able to do something completely different. I'm not able to talk about that yet, but I'm pretty excited about it. I've already pitched it to my editor, but I've got two more books on my contract before I'm allowed to give it my full attention.
Yeah. How does it feel, the idea of going into a fresh project?
Very freeing.
Yeah.
I think that with each book in a series, you build up baggage. And by the end, it's sort of a soap opera where like every time two characters are in a room together, you have to be like, all right, who killed who? Who slept with whose, you know, sister? You know, like what? Like who killed whose father? Like, you know, like do these people have any beef? Like yeah. Are they related to people who have, you know, and
yeah.
It increases with every book and it gets heavy. And that's why Robert Jordan books slowed down so much. That's why it takes so long for George Martin to write new books. You know, like I think that the more of that baggage you accumulate, the harder it gets to move forward. And so changing characters and moving ahead in time helped that a little bit for this new series, where it like gave me a clean break and allowed me to take the things that I liked, but also just approach it in a whole new way.
Yeah.
But starting something totally different where you don't have any of that baggage also has a lot of appeal. You know, The Warded Man was much easier to write than the later books because I didn't have to hold all of that knowledge in my head at the same time while I was writing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm now facing that actual predicament because the second book in my series is due out next winter. And I'm just thinking, like, also all the stuff tangled up with the publisher at the moment, but I'm looking at it and I'm going, oh, I'm gonna have to get all back into that baggage and kind of reread the work and go through all the plans for the future. And yeah, and you kind of got to go at it with, is this character affected by anything that happened in the previous scene? Like, did they know anyone that just died or anything like that? And so you've kind of got to get back into the mindset of them as well, which it takes time. You're completely right.
It does.
Yeah, we had another, Walter had a fantastic question. Do you get some sort of trophy or something when you hit bestseller? Kind of like how when you get a play button from YouTube for hitting 100,000 subs.
There's no trophy. Like my agent sent me a framed cutout of the bestseller list from the newspaper.
That's awesome.
And like I've had publishers send me like an old bottle of scotch or something like that for hitting some benchmark or another. But there's no official trophy or like hat you get to wear.
Ah, there you go, chat. The curtain's been lifted. Nothing special for becoming a New York Times bestseller.
Well, I mean, there's a royalty check, so there's that.
Well, that's rather nice. Never mind. Go like, for it.
I'd take that over a trophy any day.
That's very true. That's not a bad point, actually. Hattie, I forgot what you asked about the novellas. The novellas being, I think we were talking about being freeing. Because I've read Celia's novella. I really like that one. That was one of the ones I've listened to on audiobook. That was listening to that at work, but I got so into it that I just stopped working and I'd just be listening. Oh my gosh. Don't forgive you for the end of that either, by the way. Just got to put that on the record.
I waited 10 years to write that book. That story was supposed to happen much earlier and be part of the main series. And it just got so big that it would have interrupted the main series too much, and so I had to move it into a novella. But I had been waiting for a really long time to tell that story, and I'm so happy with how it came out.
Yeah, it was really brilliant. Celia is such a fantastic character. I love her so much. Liz says, I have trouble separating myself from my characters. Any tips on how to make the character their own person? So going back a little bit into character development here.
I guess it's one of those things that I've been pretty good about instinctually, like it's creating these fully realized personalities. I think one of the best ways to do that is to write dialogue and have them argue out the thing. Like even if you're one of those writers who doesn't like to have the serious conversation on the page, having the serious conversation off the page can really hone who your characters are. And, you know, like if they're not getting along for because of something that's happened, having them hash it out can really let you know who they are.
Yeah.
And whether you end up including that in the book or whether you just do that for your own gratification, it can really change how you see the characters and how they react to things. The other thing that I like to do is when I'm writing a group of characters, I like to take the person who's in the most pain or the struggling the most and make them the POV character, because that I think really lets the reader know who they are and lets the reader really empathize with the story.
Mm.
And so like you know, you have a love triangle and you have like two people who are smitten with each other and one person who's left out. The left out person is kind of the most interesting person in the room.
Yep.
In a lot of ways. And they add a flavor to what they see, and that flavor really like brings their voice home. I also think that like having multiple POVs allows you to really distinguish the characters more than just having one POV throughout the entire book. Not that there are plenty of people that do that and do it well, but I like jumping around and letting different characters have room to breathe.
Yeah. Do you find it refreshing to switch into like another character's perspective? You've written one character for a while, you jump over to another one, it's just like, oh.
Sometimes it's nice to let a character go, but there's always like, now I got to put this character on. And
yes.
Sometimes that means going back and like rereading something defining about them and like getting back into the mindset of like, all right, this person has these problems and now I got to like put those on and then tell a story from there. So it usually takes an hour or two of work every time I switch perspectives.
Yep.
To like get into the new character. But then, you know, I can work on a character for weeks before I switch again to somebody else, because I write the stories chronologically. So
yep.
They'll be, okay, these three chapters are this character, and like that will be an arc in the story. And so for the next 2-3 months, I'm going to be working on this character. And then after that's done, I've got to take them off and put on the next character.
Yeah, absolutely. So chronological is kind of the way you work, you said. Have you ever tried working out of sequence before?
Yes, that's why I write chronologically.
Yeah, I was going to say. It's a time.
My first books, the series that I've said I'm never going to publish, those I made up as I went along.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the writing technique of like, I'm going to write the parts that excite me, and then I'm going to find a way to tie them all together. And it works for some people. It didn't work for me. I had written myself into a corner too many times. The first version of The Painted Man was terrible. It has a whole different ending. It's only Arlen POV throughout. Like there's no other POVs, and it didn't work. And when I showed it to my agent, he was basically like, I can't sell this. This doesn't work. And so I ended up throwing out about 60% of that book and completely rewriting it from the ground up. And when I did that, I very carefully plotted out how I was going to do that rewrite. And ever since then, like I'm a big believer in like a long detailed outline. So you know exactly what's going to happen in the story before you start writing it, so that when you write the prose, you can focus on the emotional content of how do the characters feel about these things that I already know are going to happen.
Yes.
Rather than figuring out what's going to happen at the same time I'm dealing with that emotion.
Very, very true. Do you have an outlining method that you turn to?
I start out with like a short bulleted list of the major plot points in the story. And then I usually turn those into chapters, and I start filling in each chapter with more details about how those bullet points are going to come about. And then I break that out into even more chapters as they get bigger. And I figure out whose perspective is best to tell, you know, to get, there's these pieces of information I want to get to the reader, who's the POV character that's best suited to convey that. So I break out the voices as I'm breaking out the story, and I keep going back to that same file and adding to it and adding to it and adding to it over the course of a couple of months until it's maybe 150 pages of like bulleted notes of like, chapter one, this happens, this happens, this happens. Chapter two, this happens, this happens, this happens. POV change. And so when I start writing, I have a very detailed breakdown of the whole skeleton of the story. And I know that I've solved like the major plot questions before I even start.
Definitely. Do you feel like having a really strict structured outline can kind of restrict how you write the prose? Just like knowing what's going to happen, do you find yourself trying to rush to that next point rather than letting the story kind of develop and the prose tell the story as well?
No, I think it's the other way around. I think that knowing what's going to happen allows me to luxuriate in the prose more because I'm not filled with this anxiousness about what's going to happen and how I'm going to get there. Mm-hmm. I already know how I'm going to get there. And so I can focus on the character's emotions and like details about them because I'm not worried about moving them to the next point. Like I already have it laid out.
Yeah.
But it's different for everyone. It's absolutely.
No, that's a really good point. I love the word luxuriate. That's such a good way to describe the process. I'm just going to grab some more questions. I've got to scroll up so far now. Love wants to know, what type of audiobooks do you do? Or are they your own books? Or do you just, unless you just listen and I misheard, what kind of audiobooks do you listen to? I think is what we're going for there.
I listen to like mostly fantasy books. A lot of times they are, I get sent a lot of books by publishers who want me to read and provide a blurb or something like that. And so that's still mostly the pool that I draw from. But once I find an author that I like, I read all of their books for the most part. Sometimes I'll read the first book and say like, okay, I know what this author is about. I can like, if I meet them, I can have a clear conversation about their work and I could recommend it or not based on how I feel about it. And then there's other times where I get drawn into the story for real. And then like book two and book three or whatever, like I read those for me. That's how it was with Rebecca Kwong's books. I read The Poppy War because the publisher was like, hey, you know, this is our new book coming out. You should read it. And I did not read it in time to blurb it because I read the audiobook. I did the audiobook, which comes out after the book publishes.
Oh, yeah.
But then I loved them so much that I stuck with the whole series. And I've done that a number of times. But I also listen to my own audiobooks frequently. When I am switching to a different POV character, I will go back to the previous audiobook and sort of like pick the chapters that involve that character and just listen to them, go for a walk and listen to them. And that really helps me get back into the groove of that character's story. And then I can sit down and write with confidence that I've been refreshed on what's going on. So I do that. And I also like to do quality control on my audio. So I have a US narrator, a UK narrator, and a dramatic cast version from Graphic Audio. And so I listen to all of them partially for like quality control so I can like help with pronunciation and know what I'm recommending when I'm recommending them to readers. But I also do it as like my own way to reread my own work and keep up to date on things.
Is that something you would recommend to other authors as well, is just to stay familiar with their work and to reread once every now and then?
It works for me. I think that if you're writing an ongoing series, you're inevitably going to start forgetting things or just even if you don't forget the facts, some of the emotional content. And rereading them, like there are parts of the Demon Cycle that like to this day, I'll listen to it and it'll bring me to tears again. Or like, you know, like I'll feel what I felt when I was writing it. there are a couple of scenes that like...
Oh, Skype. Oh, I think we've lost you for a second. I'm very sorry, everyone. It is raining in Australia, therefore... There we go, I think we're back. Sorry, it's we've got a tropical storm outside at the moment, and the internet pits tend to fill up with water. So I think we've got you back now.
Okay, I'm...
Yeah, here we go.
I didn't lose you, so...
You didn't lose me? Okay, yeah. Sorry, you froze halfway through saying, just like getting back into the mindset of where you were when you wrote a scene.
Yeah, it can really help put you back into an emotional place so that you can stay in that place as you write the character going forward. Mm. Whereas otherwise, you might forget some of that weight.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just have to, they are actually pits. We have fiber in the ground, which they thought was a really great idea to do in a place where we have tropical cyclones and water and stuff. So when it rains, they do actually, like, our internet dies. So I wasn't joking when I said the internet pits. Love says, if, hopefully when, The Painted Man is turned into a movie or TV show, who do you picture playing Arlen or other main characters? Who's your dream cast?
It's changed, obviously. It keeps changing because 10 years ago when we were talking about who should be in the cast, I had a lot of really strong opinions, but then, you know, the rights have gone in and out of option, and, like, you know, producers and directors have been attached to it and then they're not attached to it. And so I've sort of stopped recasting it in my head. Originally, I wanted Arlen to be Chris Pine. But, like, Chris Pine from 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like Star Trek 1 Chris Pine.
Yep.
I think he'd be too old. The Arlen, the like pivotal like Arlen scenes in The Painted Man are when he's 17, 18 and when he's about 25.
Yep.
So you would need a young actor who can sort of play both of those ages. And the same thing goes for, you know, Leisha, like, her main scenes, like, she's 27, I think, at the end of The Painted Man, but, like, there's gaps where she's younger earlier on. I want young Jennifer Connelly, for Leisha. So who that is keeps changing. Numerous people that I've cast over the years. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're going to have to wait until something's in production. Right now, the rights are back with me. So it's, there's nothing on the horizon right now. There are people who are interested, but I need to feel like it's the right project before I move forward, because, you know, I've been hurt before. Mm.
Would you, and this is a question that I put to people a fair bit, would you prefer movies or a series?
I mean, personally, I think that fantasy lends itself a little bit better to TV because you're allowed to expand, and like you can make book one a whole season, and that gives you 10 hours or 12 hours instead of 2.5 or 3 hours. And that gives you a lot more room to sort of be true to the way the books were. But that doesn't mean that there aren't plenty of examples of excellent books that have been converted into movies. And so I wouldn't turn either down. Like, if it was the right team and I really felt confident that they had a good vision, like, I'd be fine with either. And like, movies for a long time were the key to like the blockbuster. But now in the Netflix age, it's sort of switching into TV. And I think that's where things are going now. And I'm cool with that.
Heck yeah. That would be amazing. Just got to say, like, a Demon Cycle Netflix series, I can see it. It would be just so cool. that's just the fangirl in me. Fingers crossed. Yeah, absolutely.
One day. Yeah.
One day. We'll make it happen. which pantheon mythology system are the demons based on? Like, did you have an inspiration that came from any kind of pantheon or previous mythology?
No. I wanted them to be elemental. I wanted them to be like, every demon is different.
Yes.
You know, they're like kaiju, like there's no two alike. And so, and the way it works is that when they rise up out of the ground, they're sort of affected by the terrain that they hunt in. And so the demons that hunt in the woods are different from the demons that hunt, you know, by the volcano or out in the sand or wherever. And so that was the kind of like variety that I wanted to put into them. And so I made them kind of unique. They weren't based on any specific mythology.
Yeah. Okay. That's really interesting. Cause I enjoyed, sounds weird to say, but I enjoyed the demons, how they were portrayed basically. Cause there was a few of them that are almost like playful, which makes them terrifying because they are just doing what demons do. There's no malice. They're just hunting. They're just feeding, you know, and that in a way is almost scarier than if they could be reckoned with or intimidated. And at times I felt like they were almost written to be a little childlike, like there's descriptions of them dancing and stuff like that, like dancing away through the flames, tearing off pieces of human flesh. Like it's, and that adds such like a different element to them that made them feel not just this is the enemy, it's this is part of the world, part of the culture, and their existence has shaped how the people in the world now live and grow up and that kind of thing. So it's fascinating to hear that there was no base inspiration. They are a creation, which is very, very cool.
I mean, for the most part, they're animals. And so like, they're not smart enough to be good or evil. You know, they sort of just are. There are demon castes that are more intelligent, and like you could judge whether, you know, a demon prince is evil or not.
Yes.
But the majority of the drones, like they know, you know, like hunt, eat, kill, you know, sleep. And so, there's no reasoning with one. And I think that's one of the things that makes them really scary is that like there's no, you can't cut a deal.
No, it's a little bit of the zombie mentality, which is I think part of what the mindlessness is what makes zombies such a scary element of fiction.
Yeah.
It's when they're hammering at the doors, at the wards, at the windows, and they're starting to I didn't want to bring him up, but Roger, he is just the most special character I've ever known, and his introduction scene, truly terrifying. I couldn't read it at night. It genuinely frightened me. Just like the sounds of like the wood cracking and leading up to it where they're saying we need to refresh the wards, like the wards need to be refreshed. And you knew what was going to happen, but my God, it was next level. But that kind of inevitability when they got through the wards, and it was just simple wood between the characters that we'd spent the last couple of pages getting to know and this outside force that has just been present throughout the series so far. That's a truly special kind of fear. Not one that I found quite often in book series, to be quite honest.
That was one of the scenes that when I first met with a director to turn the book into a movie, that was one of the scenes that the director was like, here's how I envision that shot. You know, like, you know, they're going to be in their common room, and then there's going to be this huge crash at the door, and you're going to see just a little crack, and then like some dust is going to like slowly fall down, and then like there'll be a moment of silence, you know, like, and then like it's one of those moments that sort of comes to life. So it's interesting that you still, that was one of the things that stuck with you because
it stands out. It stands out. And I do believe that would translate very well to screen. I'm not a script writer, but that, I could see it. And that, it sticks with you. I tell you that it's been 3 years since I've read the books. I remember that as clear as day. Someone else had a brilliant question in here. I play Dungeons and Dragons and also Pathfinder, says Love. It would be so awesome to have a Demon Cycle RPG battling the demons. Do you play tabletop role-playing games?
I was raised on Dungeons and Dragons. I was playing Dungeons and Dragons way before it was cool. Like those kids on Stranger Things, like that was me and my friends in the 80s. And so that had a huge influence on my writing. I think that, but it also, I needed to stop playing for a while in order to actually get any real writing done. For years in college and after college, I was the dungeon master and I was writing up my own adventures and like writing these incredibly detailed stories and like backstories for all of the characters. I was putting so much of my creative energy into gaming that I was not doing any writing. I was scratching that itch a different way.
Yeah.
And it wasn't when the gaming group broke up that I really started to put that energy into my writing instead. But one of the things that I learned from that was when you're running a game, you have this incredibly elaborate plot that involves with, you know, like you have to talk to the innkeeper and you're going to get this piece of information and it's going to give you a clue and it's going to lead you here and lead you here and lead you here. And then your characters just kill the innkeeper and don't ask him any questions. And you have to figure out how to get the story back on track, like mm-hmm. in real time. That is what that I learned more about writing by doing that.
Yes.
By seeing in real time what bored people and, you know, what kept them interested, I think is a really good lesson for a writer.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I'm also a forever DM. One day I would like to actually get to play. I am actually playing in an Age of Rebellion game at the moment, which is fantastic, but I had the same kind of revelations. I only got into D&D again in 2018. That was a good year. And it was the same. I started writing my own stories and kind of seeing how they reacted to it and having to make allowances for when they, just killed the innkeeper. And I was like, I now need to figure out how to get this information across to you. So is there like, and you started figuring out what people picked up on in terms of world building clues. So if you're describing a room, they would go, hang on, what's under the rug? And so it's like, you've painted the idea of this room. For some reason, they've gone straight to like the rug or just, and it's just subtle show, but don't tell kind of thing. And you can describe a room, they'll latch onto something. It's like, okay, so we have this certain way of thinking about rooms, images in our head that are going to tell certain clues. And kind of boiling that down to a mechanic that I could then replicate in my writing, I think made me a much more descriptive writer as well. In almost, I want to say shorthand, but that's not right. What would usually be a page of purple prose would be a paragraph, and it would describe the same. Because your players don't like to sit there and listen to half an hour of narration. So you got to figure out how to get the information across. They get bored.
If you don't keep them entertained enough with role-playing and story, they will just kill the innkeeper and rob them. And so you have to learn how to keep this small audience occupied. And when you learn how to keep that audience occupied in real time, that is an incredible tool for a writer.
Yeah, definitely.
For a toolbox.
Yeah. Would you recommend that writers become DMs temporarily, not to get lost in the world and devolve from writing time?
I think it's a worthwhile experience. I mean, you can get some of those same experiences as a player. Mm. A lot of times you'll want to get the other players to do X, and they don't want to do X, they want to do Y, and you have to make that interesting so that they'll take the story in the direction you want to go. Mm. So there's a lot of ways to get there, but I do think that role-playing games provide a really good opportunity to sort of give a test run to creative ideas.
Yeah, definitely. Would you ever just off the books kind of homebrew your own Demon Cycle game and maybe just have a couple of close friends come in and play?
It's in the works, sort of. I mean, it's one of those things where I would want to write the manual myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I would want to write the player's handbook myself. And I don't have time to do that because I'm like getting paid to write novels. And so I would either need to have another creator that I really trust on a very intimate level to help with that, or it's just one of those projects that I have to put off until I have time to do it. Yeah. I do have a lot of readers who have come to me saying, like, I'm running a Demon Cycle based D&D game, can you give me some ideas on how to adapt the rules to fit? And so, like, I've sort of thrown suggestions around there to like make it a little closer, but I haven't really sat down and done all of the mechanics myself, but I want to. It's just one of those projects.
Infinity project, like what Hattie was mentioning before. Yeah. One of the projects that's exactly. Just like,
Demon Cycle role-playing game is my Infinity project.
That would be absolutely amazing. I would probably, that'd be really exciting. We've got quite a few more questions coming through, but I know that you are in a bit of a time crunch, so I think we'll start wrapping it up. So we'll just go through just a couple more, and then I'll let you get on with your evening. Walter says, do you find there is a difference in how your story tells from writing it down, hearing it in your head, and reading it aloud? So do you use that sort of technique to feel how your story is going? Basically, when you write it down and then read it back, does it sound like a different... Is there a difference between that? I think that's what Walter is asking.
I never read my stuff aloud. I listen to my audiobooks, so I hear it read after it's finished.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not one of those writers who reads their own work aloud. I don't do readings at events. I hate it. Hate it so much. I don't read it out loud to myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I do reread the same writing very critically several times before I'm done tinkering with it.
Yep.
And so, as I said before, like, I'll write something the night before, and then the next night when I'm ready to start writing, I'll reread what I wrote and totally change everything, because that 24 hours has given me perspective on that, you know, how I can make it better. I know plenty of authors who do read their stuff aloud and it helps them. So mm-hmm. I'm not down on it. It's just not how I roll.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And are you a, Jov wants to know if you're a PC gamer. Any video games that kind of caught your attention?
For many years, I did not allow a gaming console in my house because I know, like with D&D, that if I had a gaming console, I would not get any writing done.
Yeah.
During the pandemic, I did break that somewhat. Just because, you know, we're all stuck at home. So I got an Oculus Quest 2.
Yes.
And the game that I love the most is called In Death Unchained.
Okay.
Basically, it's a first-person shooter where you are skulking around these castles in the afterlife. You start out in Purgatory, and then you move into Paradise Lost, and then you move down to the Abyss. And, it really feels like you're hiding behind pillars and ducking under a crenellation, mm-hmm. and like there's Templar knights and like these monks with bows and arrows and zombies and banshees and you're basically sort of just like hunting your way to like kill all of these monsters that have tried to take over the afterlife. And it really feels like you're there.
Yeah.
And like that, more than any other game, like the VR game, like I play it standing up so I can spin around and shoot here and shoot there. And I've never played a game that was that engrossing before. And I really like, I'm super addicted to it right now.
Absolutely. I had a similar response when I played Blade and Sorcery. So it's like a VR game with, you basically just put in like a gladiator ring, but you start off in like a little tavern, and you can go upstairs. There's a training room upstairs where you can like learn to fire a bow and arrow, and you're going like, this feels weird. But I spent so long in just that little tavern because, like, as a fantasy author, as a DM, I've described this kind of room so many times, but here I am standing in one, and I was just spending so much time just kind of wandering around and picking up plates, and VR is interesting time. It's very immersive, obviously, but I think with that genre of games and stuff, for people who spend a lot of time in fantasy realms to then literally be in one, is very different, and was a new side of gaming for me, and was very, very interesting. I really enjoyed it, so I'm glad to hear that it's working out for you. It's not too much of a distraction.
I mean, look, we're all trapped in our homes, and so like being able to like put on a VR headset and be somewhere else is really nice right now. But it eats up my time, but like I also kind of feel like, all right, I'm gonna put it on, I'm gonna kill zombies for an hour, and then I'm gonna go like take it off and feel a lot calmer and be able to go about my life.
Yeah.
It's not the same as Neverwinter Nights was for me, where I just like lost countless hours, you know, like in a vacuum because I was just swept up in it. I like games where I can sort of pick it up and play for a short period of time and then stop.
Definitely.
The games where you get too involved like are great, but they keep me, they take my creative energy away from where I want it to be.
Yes, exactly. I, for some reason in 2019, I decided to start a Twitch channel, and now we're here. So I have almost no time for writing because playing video games is my full-time job, which is like the ultimate distraction. It's not too bad. It's not too bad.
It's kind of an awesome job though. So
this is my second month of being a full-time content creator, and I can legitimately say I've never been busier, which I think is why we really struggled to find like a scheduled time for this. There's no way we could have done this while I was still working, because this is just, yeah, this is certainly a time. I thought I'd have to struggle to find things to do, but I'm working 6-7 day weeks, and it's not to make ends meet. That's kind of taken care of. It's because I have all these Infinity projects, and I've for so long I've worked my entire adult life in public libraries and academic libraries, and every time I've been standing at a reference desk being like, oh, if I had time, there's this project I would do, and now I have the time, and so all of the projects are coming forth. So it's interesting.
Fantastic.
When you get a whole lot
must
of time.
Must be a great feeling.
It's pretty cool. I just streaming is my main, and I really, really enjoy it. Spending time with the community, and just, you guys have all been really amazing today, by the way. Just thank you for showing up and asking such brilliant questions. And I think there's a couple of your fans in here as well who are really enjoying the experience. So it is fantastic.
Now I'm going to read through this. I haven't been able to keep up with it while I've been talking. So I'm going to read through it afterward.
Yeah. Go for it.
So appreciative of everyone who's been asking questions and joining in. Like, it means a lot.
Yeah, definitely.
People still remember who I am.
Of course. Absolutely, of course. There was one last question I'll say from Joff, which we've kind of already answered, which is, what does the future hold for this series? Like, we're coming back to this world. We know that now. We've got three books. Three books, first coming out in August.
I've got that whole story arc of three books planned out. So I know where that's going to end, and I don't expect it to get longer in the telling as some series tend to do. I think I'm going to end on three, and then I have another project that I'm going to work on, and then who knows after that, but that covers like the next 5 to 10 years of my creative life. So
yep.
I haven't plotted out further than that.
Absolutely.
I'm really excited about the new series. I think that people who are already fans of my work can just pick it up and run, but people who have never heard of me before can start with this new series and not have to worry that they didn't read the other books and get a really satisfying adventure that like makes complete sense on its own.
Yeah.
But then if they like it and they want to go back to the other series,
there's
the other
more.
Series is still, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's really brilliant. And I agree with books are my crack. Roll on August. Still love that username. That is just brilliant. that's not far away. How are you feeling? When we were first organizing this, you were just going through copy editing, I think.
Yeah, the book is done now.
And it's
so
done.
Yeah, I mean, there's still the proofread, so like they might change a comma or something, but all of the real creative work on the book is completely done, and I am so happy with it now. Like, it was a hard road getting to this point. I think that the shift from third person to first person, the shift, you know, of jumping forward in time quite a bit, but also just the uniqueness of some of the characters. Longtime readers know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
Made the book very challenging to write, but I am so happy with how it came out, and I can't wait now for people to read it. At this point, like, only a small handful of people have actually read the book. There's like the people who are tied into the book production, and then like a handful of reviewers and authors have it, you know, for blurbing, and that's it. Yeah. And like my mom. So I'm really, really excited for it to get out in the world.
Absolutely.
To start getting people to think about it.
Yeah. Do we have a date for the cover reveal? Or have I already missed
it? The cover art is done, and it's fantastic. Right now, we're just going back and forth about like the fonts for the title.
Mm-hmm.
So I expect that we will do a cover reveal sometime in the next 10 days to 2 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
Like, really. And the cover is by Tommy Arnold, who's like amazing and has done a lot of the best covers that are out there right now. And he hit it out of the park. This cover is so good. So I'm really excited to launch it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've just got to say, we need all borders and everything to open up and clear up, because I need this signed. I found this copy of it down in like a little seaside town in South Australia. For some reason, this little independent bookstore just had them, and I've never seen them anywhere else, this version of The Painted Man.
Those books were a special edition from the Supernova convention in 2016.
Yep.
So I was with Supernova in Adelaide, and oh my God, why am I blanking on the other city?
Brisbane?
Yes, Adelaide and Brisbane. It was a very emotional time because I got up that morning. I voted for Hillary Clinton. I got on the plane, and then I landed in Australia, and I saw that Donald Trump had won instead. So like, that was quite a trip.
That's a time.
But they made that edition of the book for that convention. They only made a couple hundred of them. It's very rare. And so there was like one case or like a couple of cases that they gave to Dimmicks, mm-hmm. and other bookstores, but the rest of them were like a con exclusive that I would just sign there at the convention and nowhere else.
Yeah.
And so there's only a couple of hundred of those made. Keep it secret and safe.
I will try. It's a little scuffed. Some of the cover is falling off. I'm doing my best to keep it safe, but I have no idea how I ended up with one of them, because
the cover is they use this technique to make the paper textured, so it sort of looks like a leather book, but it's actually just paper, and yeah. So it is a little more fragile than like a proper leather book would be.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's gorgeous.
It is
really
stunning.
I really love that edition. And it was nice to have something that was just unique to that one convention and that one trip to Australia.
Yeah. How did you find Australia when you were here?
That was my second trip there. I was also there in 2010 for the World Science Fiction Convention in Melbourne. And then while I was there, I went to Sydney. And so I had... two cities on my first trip, and then Adelaide and Brisbane on the second trip. And I love Australia. I love the people. I really, it feels very comfortable to me, and yet also a little different in ways that give it a unique flavor. And so like, I enjoyed the hell out of it. And I really like felt so welcomed. My first trip, when I went out for the convention in 2010, like nobody had ever really heard of me as an author. I only had two books out at the time, and like my career was still getting started. And I did a signing at Dimmicks, and like there was a line out the door, and I was not expecting that at all.
Wow.
And it's, Australia is one of my strongholds. I love visiting.
Heck yeah. I mean, when we can, like if you ever come back to Brisbane, I'll take you around. My parents own a nice cafe. They do good coffee. We'll go get a coffee or something.
As soon as we're allowed to travel again.
Oh, yes, I cannot wait. And I just out of curiosity, what is your favorite con to go to?
I mean, there's a lot of them that I really like. I liked Supernova, and what I liked about it was that it was like a traveling roadshow. You know, it's the same people that do the convention in both cities, and they sort of like truck you from one city to the other, and so like the guests all get to hang out, like, you know, I get to hang out with Nathan Fillion for a while, which is awesome.
Just in the
week between the weekends when they did the convention, they would like give us a bunch of fun stuff in Australia to do. So like, you know, we all went and like held a koala and like went to, like surfing down a sand dune, and
yes.
So that was an incredible time and really a thrill. I like the Leipzig Book Festival in Germany has always been amazing. I like New York Comic Con is like my home con, and so that one's nice because I can go, but then I can also leave. But then there's Comic Cons in other cities that I really love because I can go there and like have a weekend of just hanging out at the bar with other authors and other like publishers and stuff, and sort of meeting fans and getting to meet a lot of people. But then I've been to like really small conventions that are intimate and let you have a deep dive into like talking about literature, like Imaginal in Epinal, France is like, the French ask very different questions about books than other cultures, and much more literary questions. And mm-hmm. I really enjoy that sort of change of pace. One of the best things about this job has been that I get to travel. the first 35 years of my life, I never really went anywhere other than the US and Canada, and maybe like a vacation in the Caribbean once or twice. Since then, I've been to so many different countries. I get to go to two or three different countries that I've never been to a year for like 10 years. And it really, it's life-changing. So I'm very fortunate in that regard.
Absolutely. And I dare say you're missing it now this year. Would you travel regularly before all of this hit? And this is kind of...
This is the longest I've gone without being on an airplane in like my adult life. Certainly since my career started. Normally I'm in and out, every couple of months. I'm not going to look back on my deathbed and wish I hadn't spent so much time with my family.
Yeah.
But I do miss going new places and seeing people and running into Robin Hov randomly in Poland, and having dinner together and, things like that. It just don't happen in quarantine.
I so totally understand that. And love, I agree. We'll take you on a wine tour of the famous Barossa Valley down in Adelaide. Do you have any Adelaide wines, Australian wines down there?
I did while I was there. I don't remember names offhand. I'm more of a wine drinker than a beer drinker. So
The Barossa, the Harndorf, not Harndorf, no, not really Harndorf. McLaren Vale, that's what I'm thinking of. So all the surrounding areas of Adelaide are big winemaking regions. And I'm an Adelaide export, moved from there to Brisbane. And boy, oh boy, I miss the wine. I used to live down the road from the Penfolds Winery. It's just not the same climate up here for grape growing. So Adelaide is a treat for wine lovers. So
yeah,
it's a good time. And
you still go back home sometimes? You still have family there?
Yeah, but our interstate borders close kind of overnight at the moment with just the instability of the current world climate. And someone's trying to call me repeatedly. That makes me very hesitant to book a flight to go down and see my family because I may get stuck down there or I may lose a lot of money on a plane. So it's kind of like, the borders are open-ish. I go back when I can, but currently just happy to sit and work for a bit.
Yeah, no, there's pluses and minuses to the weird world we've had for the last year. I'm gonna just flip on the light switch. It's gotten dark here while we've been talking.
Yeah, I
suddenly realized that I was sitting in darkness.
No, you're fine. I realized I said about half an hour. I'll be able to roll up and let you go work, and then we started talking about travel.
So she may run in at any moment.
That is absolutely fine. We had an episode of the podcast on Saturday night where the small version of our guest came in and just took over the entire show, and chat was far more enamored with the small person than they were with us.
She would easily do that.
I can imagine. How was acting class? Everything went okay? It was all smooth?
Oh, her acting class yesterday? Yeah, they did Frozen renditions. So she got to be Elsa and sing Let It Go. She was very excited.
The dream. That's just the dream right there. We can talk about world travel. We can talk about playing video games for a living, but I reckon that's got it nailed right there. I think we're all wound up with questions. So thank you all very much, everyone, for tuning in today. I just want to say thank you so much for spending your time with us today and chatting. It has been beyond interesting. And I really, really appreciate you taking the time.
This was great. I apologize for the trouble we had scheduling it. We both had trouble. But I'm so happy I did this. And it's nice to realize that I remember how to talk to humans that I had forgot.
I know the feeling, trust me, I really do. This is my full-time job and I still no. Absolutely. And
anyway, this is really great, so thank you.
No, it was really awesome. So I think what we'll do now, chat, is we're gonna raid off and we're gonna go and say hello trying to figure out who we're gonna give the love to. I think we'll go say hello to Dust. He was our guest the other night. So basically what will happen now is I'll flick us over to another screen once I send off the lovely darlings. And thank you so much to everyone for popping in, asking questions. This was a brilliant, brilliant chat. I'll see you guys Saturday night. We're going to be playing some games and stuff then, as per usual. And otherwise, I'm going to flick us onto our screen, give us a mute, and then I'll say goodbye to you and finish up like that, I think. So everyone, thank you so heckin' much. And Mr. Brett, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Tea and Tales. If you'd like to learn more, head over to www.skynation.info or email me at reneeskyplays@gmail.com. See you next time.